The Flanacast, a Mike Flanagan recap podcast, covers material that, as is often true within the horror genre, may contain mature themes that are not intended for younger listeners. For specific content warnings pertaining to this episode, please refer to the show notes. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, world.
Hello, world. Welcome to the Flanacast. Welcome to the Flanacast.
Is that the new theme song?
I just decided it was. It was a bold choice.
It's really bold, and I love it. Here for it. I am Dina Grilly.
I am Michelle Macaron. This is the Flanacast.
In case you didn't get that from our amazing song.
It was jaunty.
And we are here to take you through a very special work by Mr. Mike Flanagan. Ouija, Origin of Evil.
Now, I thought it was Ouija 2, Origin of Evil, but Dina informed me that they dropped the sequel, the squeakquel number 2, because...
It's not Ouija 2, Electric Boogaloo.
No, it is not. Before we start, I do have a disclaimer that I watched like a sad dog video about a mother dog and two puppies that needed a foster home. It had pretty much everything but Sarah McLachlan music behind it, and we fell for it hook, line, and sinker. So we now, in our somewhat small one-bedroom New York City apartment, currently have 4 dogs, 1 pug, 1 rambunctious, neurotic mother who has been abandoned, and 2 very, very playful puppies that you will probably hear in the background. Think about it as additional very cute ASMR for this episode, please.
We'll post some pictures. For sure. They are cute. So anyway, this was a movie that Mike Flanagan probably never saw himself making.
Mm-hmm. It's a challenge.
It does. And I think that brings us to the second disclaimer already of the podcast. We're on like, what, minute 1.5? And we're already disclaiming several things. We are not recapping Ouija, but we probably will be spoiling it because a lot of the plot points from Ouija Origin of Evil will relate since it is a prequel, and we will be discussing that. Probably better off that we're not recapping Ouija.
We're helping you, really.
Neither of us were a huge fan of it. Strangely, it made more money than Ouija Origin of Evil. It made about $20 million more. So yeah, so we'll get into all that kind of stuff later. But we just did want to mention that you may or may not want to put yourself through watching that as well before listening to this recap. Both are available to stream on Netflix.
I mean, if you need something to, like, do your taxes to or something, I guess, you know, put in Ouija 1.
So both movies are based on the currently trademarked by Hasbro board game of the same name. Before it was owned by Hasbro, it was owned by Parker Brothers. I'm pretty sure that the one that I was bought when I was a kid is
Parker Brothers.
Mm-hmm. I had the one that had like the black background and like the kid on the front, like with the planchette. Mm-hmm. Did you have a Ouija board, Michelle?
Oh no, my mother is incredibly Catholic and thought that it was, you know, evil or whatever. So I would go to other people's houses. But as someone who vehemently hates board games, I did not mind the Ouija because you could like fuck around with it. Like, you know, it was fun and spooky. Like, I love murder mysteries, but Clue was just too much for me. Like most games for this only child who just liked to make up things was too much. So I didn't mind the Ouija board.
I'm surprised you strike me as a Clue girl.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of wanted to dress up as all of them, but.
Okay. Yes, that tracks.
I mean, what do you have like a scariest Ouija experience from like a sleepover or something?
You know, the one that I think is stuck in my brain still is when we brought the Ouija board outside. I brought it to a friend's house and we were in the backyard because again, her mother was like, "Don't play that in the house." A lot of people were just very against. Even I don't even think my mother liked that I had it. She didn't buy it for me. My grandmother bought me my Ouija board, and it was a Christmas gift.
Wow. Happy birthday, Jesus.
Thanks, Nanny. So, you know, I got my Ouija board. It was like the top of my Christmas list that year. And I brought it to a friend's house. And the mother was like, "You're not playing that in the house. Get that outside, girls. I don't want it in here." And we were like, "Well, we're going to go play it outside." So we were like in her backyard trying to contact the dead.
And was her backyard a graveyard by any chance?
No, it was not. Her backyard was like right behind the grocery store parking lot. So not really mystical at all. Not really. It didn't feel like, oh, good place for a seance. It like was the worst place for a seance. But like, you know, it was moving and it was like answering like yes or no. We were asking like, you know, like, am I going to get a good grade on my math test? Is anybody there? Yes. What's your name? Bob. You know, like random shit. Mm-hmm, but then all of a sudden out of nowhere, like a whole bunch of earwigs started climbing out from underneath the Ouija board. And like we ran away, like we like dropped everything and like just ran screaming. We went back. We looked for like a hole. Like where could these bugs have come from? And there wasn't one. And we took that as proof that, like, the spirit world had sent them. We were like, 9.
I have to be perfectly honest that you said earwigs. That is a type of bug I now remember. But I just was thinking of, like, mini drag queens that were ears that were all wearing wigs. Does it make sense? No. Is it the way my brain works? Yes.
Now whenever I think of that memory, I'm always going to picture just, you know, like Bianca Del Rio with like antenna coming out from under and going, ah!
It would be a look. It's a good look.
It would be what a look. So, you know, Ouija boards have a very interesting history. Like when you think about the fact of like, you know, we called it a board game just now. We were kids, right? Like, what was your scary Ouija board experience?
I don't really know if I had that many scary ones. It was just like, you know, because I was also a gullible child who couldn't lie. So, you know, every time I would be like, who's moving it? And everyone would say no. And I fully believed it because I was such a rule follower.
They may not have been moving it though. So like do you know?
Yeah, the whole, you know, like your mind kind of subliminally does it, right?
Mm-hmm. So like you really can all believe that you're not moving it. Like it happens by this phenomena of, you know, your body kind of impulsively moves and it's like disconnected from your conscious mind. And many people believe that that's how the Ouija board works. But yeah, so I mean, you know, there was every time we played, are you moving it? Are you moving it? No, I'm not moving it. No.
Yeah.
Of course. No. And even if they were, no one was ever going to admit it.
I would have admitted it if I did it. And that's why I'm a fool, I guess.
No. By the time I think that anybody would have like admitted it, I think we had moved on to like light as a feather, stiff as a board. So the Ouija board does have a pretty interesting and wild history. If I were to go into it, we would need like a whole other episode for it.
Oh, I wonder if anyone has a book about it because it like really is a fascinating. Spiritualism in general, fascinating.
So I don't think that there is a book per se, at least not that I just went straight to podcasts to see if I could listen to any. And there is a podcast that I thought was particularly, it was particularly good. I'm looking for the name. Stuff You Missed in History Class.
Oh, I used to love that podcast.
Covered the entire U.S. history of the Ouija board specifically, not like talking boards in general, but the Ouija board with a two-part episode that is fascinating and like covers all the ups and downs. The basic gist is that spiritualism became like really hyped after the Civil War. Like all these people in our country had died in the war and everyone wanted to contact them. So that's when like the talking board became like the like particularly popular in America. So these two dudes, Charles Kennard and Elijah Bond, patented like a spirit board or a talking board, and it had, you know, letters and goodbye and hello and yes and like pretty much the one that you can buy now at, I guess not Toys R Us because where's there a Toys R Us, but you can buy at any toy game store, etc. And
it's a never failing amusement and recreation for all classes.
Mm-hmm. They basically didn't like they marketed it as a tool for spiritualists, but particularly for entertainment. Like that asterisk of entertainment purposes only was like very heavy in the patent, which they applied for in 1898. And it named itself.
Yeah.
their sister-in-law and medium Helen Peters Nosworthy was there when they did it, when they like, you know, said Ouija board, you know, or
it's kind of like when you let a kid name a cat.
Yeah. But someone did point out that it's oui, like yes in French, and ja, like yes in German.
Yes in German. Yeah, I saw that.
So it's basically yes, yes. Sure. And then there's this, like, did you read up on any of like the crazy things of, I don't know why I always bring up Succession, but they just, how many different people kept trying to cut each other out of a cut of the profits from the patent?
Oh, I didn't do that, but I did see the thing about like the patent. They had to prove that it worked.
Yeah, like because they didn't want to explain like how it worked, but yes, they had to bring it in to the patent office, and they basically, the question that the patent officer asked was, "What is my name?"
Mm-hmm.
And the board spelled it out. But the inventor, right, one of them, I can't remember if it was Bond or the other guy, one of them was a patent lawyer. And worked with the office a lot, so probably did know just the man's know the name. So just, you know, then they got into business with someone else who was financing them. Eventually, that person kind of cut everybody else out of the profits. Then there was this kind of like foreman at the factory who like kind of randomly moved up into the general, like almost like CEO position at the time, who then his brother got involved. Then he cut the brother. It was like, it's this wild ride of like spiritualism meets capitalism. And if you, I would highly recommend that podcast, or even just looking up, go into an internet deep dive, fall into a Wikipedia hole on the history of the Ouija board, because it's pretty, pretty ridiculous. So the first Ouija movie that, again, we are not covering, came out in 2014. Mm-hmm. You know, were they licensing a lot of like games at the time or anything? Or they just randomly woke up one day and said, I want to make a Ouija movie? I didn't look that part up.
I mean, I feel like games and toys have been trying to kind of bank in on that forever. So it might just be that Hasbro wanted to see about it.
Maybe sales were low and they wanted to find a way to hype it back up. And after they'd paid money to, you know.
I mean, 2014, it. I mean, like 2010s, 2020 is like heavy, heavy nostalgia time for the 90s. Yeah. And the 90s were resurgence of the 60s. So, yeah. You know, it makes sense that
it's all cyclical.
People, yeah, would be interested in it.
I mean, people wanted to see it. It made over $100 million in box office. Mike Flanagan actually consulted for it. I think that's kind of how he peripherally ended up involved in the second one. So it was not a good movie, but it certainly was a popular one. It was PG-13, so I guess, you know, there's that teen audience.
Yeah, there was no sex. Mm-hmm. There was very little. I mean, there was very little plot. So.
Yeah, well, there wasn't. You know, Mike Flanagan referred to it as a standard elimination horror movie.
That's exactly what it was. It like was like a Final Fantasy sort of mishigas.
You mean Final Destination?
What did I say?
Final Fantasy.
It's not the same thing. It's not the same thing, Dina.
It's not the same thing. Yeah, you know, basically just like the teens in the movie just got kind of knocked off one at a time by the Ouija ghost, who you do find out who they are at the end. Like you do very much get some kind of story, but it was so vague that it left it very open for an origin story, which
because you always think that, you know, there's going to be a sequel or a prequel.
So it was produced by Blumhouse, and Jason Blum approached Mike Flanagan and said, we would like for you to be involved in the sequel. Like, we would love for you to make it. And didn't really have any ideas, like, was just very much like, make another Ouija movie, blank slate, and guaranteed him distribution and said, we'll concede to pretty much anything you want as long as it relates back in some way to the first movie. And Mike Flanagan,
amazing creative license.
I know. And at first he was still kind of hesitant because he didn't see himself doing sequels. He was like, I don't know what I'm really going to bring to this. I don't know. Like, the first movie wasn't very good. Like, I don't really see the way in. But, you know, apparently he says that Jason Blum doesn't really take no for an answer. He will find any way to sweeten the deal. for you to take it. And so he was like, really, literally anything you see, we will find a way to support you and make that happen. So he said, well, I want it to be a prequel. I want it to be a period piece. And I don't want to do like a lot of intense jump scares. I want it to be a family drama. I want these things. And they're like, yeah, whatever you want. Great. The check's written.
I mean, there is a good amount of jump scares though.
There are, but they're not like cheap ones.
Yeah, like, no, they're really good.
You know, he's like, I want it to be a family drama first. So the other thing he said, well, the other thing that Blumhouse then came back to him with was that Universal did not want any evidence of cigarettes. If it was going to take place in the 60s, it couldn't have cigarettes.
That's so random.
Yeah. Well, it was PG-13. And at the time, that was when they were really starting to cut that smoking out. Or, you know, like now we're back to putting smoking into things, but with a warning. But there was a time period where like really nothing had cigarettes in it.
What a shame.
Yeah. So, I mean, they even gave him a hard time at some point, like about an ashtray in a scene. They said you can't have an ashtray in the restaurant scene, which we'll talk about later. He wanted like haze, like smoke in the mm-hmm. room, and they were like, let's have a talk about that, because where would that be coming from? And he made a joke, well, couldn't there just be a fire?
I was about to say, maybe there's just someone with a fog machine.
Couldn't there have been a grease fire in the kitchen? You know, and eventually they conceded to allow it. But I mean, that is a big ask for the 60s, to be like, never a cigarette in anyone's hand, never an ashtray. But in hindsight, he said he doesn't even particularly notice it. Or care.
Well, they don't
that.
Even mention alcohol when she goes to the party. They only mention coffee.
Yes.
And then, like, allude
yes.
to it being alcohol, now that I'm thinking about it.
Yeah. So they were very careful about all substances at that point. And he ended up really loving working on the film. Like, anytime he talks about this film, he talks about it fondly, his experience. They made it in L.A. Both houses, the inside house and the outside house, were both in L.A. And I believe Lights Out was filmed in the interior.
In the I thought it was the anterior.
The interior. The interior. They used it.
Oh yeah,
for
it
Lights
is.
Out, they used yeah. they cleared out, and 3 days later, this film shot.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. So the movie only grossed $80 million. And so there have been no Ouija sequels after. On Tumblr, Mike Flanagan said he had single-handedly revitalized and destroyed the Ouija franchise.
Point. Period. Done.
Yeah. And you know, just another little trivia thing just relating to episode one of our podcast. He basically, after this film was finished, immediately headed to Alabama to film Gerald's Game and missed mm-hmm. the premiere of Ouija Origin of Evil to be in Alabama filming. Apparently when he took the crew to, because I mean, it is the same crew that made it, they went to a small movie theater in Alabama opening weekend to see it. And there was something wrong with like the projection, like it was too dim and like it was out of focus slightly, and Mike Flanagan went and complained to management, and management tried to tell him that that's the way the filmmakers wanted it to be shown, and he was sir, I can assure you that it's not true.
Oh no, what a bad day for that teenager.
So that's just a little background, and you know we're already so far into this episode, but there's a lot of background we had to cover, and this is one of the Mike Flanagan films that is on physical media, although it's a little hard to come by. I had to buy a used copy from a library on Blu-ray.
Yeah, I saw it, and you gave it to me, and then it wouldn't read in the Blu-ray player that I procured, so.
It did read in mine, so I was able to check out some of the Blu-ray bonus features, and it made me realize just how great it is to, like, I feel like working on this podcast has really brought me back to my appreciation for physical media and my like love and respect for it. And Mike Flanagan is like huge on physical media because of the bonus features. He loves to do a director's commentary, but also just the fact of like something we talked about in episode zero, which is a scam. Streaming is a
fickle beast.
You know, they promised us a lot and then turn themselves into cable, and the idea of a digital license is a scam. So anyway, you know, they talked about, you know, in a lot of the bonus features, the background that I got was that they really wanted this to be rooted in like a family drama. When they took their first pass at this script, they really didn't put the horror elements into it. They really were focused on it's a grieving family that is dealing with the loss of the father and dealing with, you know, trying to make things work, trying to make their family work without mm-hmm. him and stay afloat. And then the second pass is where they added a lot more of like those like scarier moments, but basically they treated it just like a straight up like drama first.
Was the priest in the first go around?
I believe he was. It was like, it was more like the little like scares and then like, you know, like, and then we see the guy in the corner and then we like, you know, yeah. but like the Ouija board working, I'm assuming was still part of the original script. I don't think they like, yeah. they didn't write a movie and then put a Ouija board in it the second time around. I think it is a Ouija movie. So I'm pretty sure that was there the whole time.
I mean, I don't know.
I wasn't maybe, in the room. I don't know.
Maybe it's just like, I don't know, something random, like a banana or something instead of a Ouija board.
It was Scrabble. Actually.
Okay.
and he did have a co-writer for this, just to put that out there, who his name is Jeff Howard. So I mean, he also couldn't speak highly enough of Lulu Wilson in a lot of the, so good. Yeah, she did her own stunts, which I learned from the special features.
And do we want to talk about the fact that this cast features a lot of Flanniverse people, future Flanniverse people?
This is the first appearance for a few people, and then also a return appearance for someone who's going to be coming back. So he used Annalise Basso in this movie. She plays the older sister.
Mm-hmm. She's an Oculus, right?
And she is an Oculus, and she will be returning for The Life of Chuck. So keeping it all in the family there. And this is the first movie for Henry Thomas and for Elizabeth Reeser. Mm-hmm. So, you know,
but both will be featured in my favorite, The Haunting of Hill House.
Oh, yes. They'll be coming back. And basically, Henry Thomas and Mike Flanagan, like, verbalized to each other while working on this how much they loved working together. That when Mike Flanagan was like, would you, you know, ever consider coming back and doing anything for me again? He's like, no, I will do everything that you do. And that's why he's one of those actors that's literally like never that's
what he does. Yeah.
Yeah. He is always there.
And Henry Thomas is just so great at being either the most likable guy or also the least likable guy, but like it always can swing one way or the other. He's very talented
and he's very good at that pivot, right? Mm-hmm. I'm nice until I snap, or you know, in this, because of the possession aspect, you know, he's, you know, such a nice man and then he's possessed by the demon and then all of a sudden he's like super scary, and he does have that in him and it's pretty awesome. He said that they laughed a lot while filming. That was another thing, that the kids pulled a lot of tricks on the crew, like pranks and stuff. And that they were always laughing. So he thinks very fondly of this. Everyone found the house creepy. That was another thing I found out. So that was just a little bit of background about the filming experience from what we were very fortunate to have in terms of physical media and bonus features.
Ooh, bonus features.
Love a bonus feature. It's like Tumblr before there was Tumblr.
This podcast could be sponsored by Tumblr. How often we say Tumblr because of Mike Flanagan's affinity for Tumblr.
Listen, Mike Flanagan loves Tumblr, so now we love Tumblr. I don't follow anyone else, but I literally just use it to creep on Mike Flanagan. So
all
right. Here we
don't give away all your secrets, Dina.
I don't want to appear to be speaking on his behalf. And also, he wrote all of those things himself. So I don't be like, oh, I gleaned that by extensive research. No, I creeped on his Tumblr. So should we jump into the recap? Are we ready?
Let's recap it. Yes.
Let's recap this bitch. All right. So we begin with the vintage Universal logo.
Yeah, which I like so much more.
I know. It's nice. Anything. It's not really anything. Nice. And he requested to use it, and they offered it to him because of the idea that he wanted it to feel nostalgic. He was very much going for like Poltergeist vibes, like mm-hmm. very like early 70s, late, you know, like that kind of picture. And so we start in LA, 1967.
My first comment was that we see the size of the sign in the front yard for this fortune-telling business is it's ridiculous. Was this like zone for this? It was a large sign, right? I'm not crazy.
Oh, no, it's a very large sign, especially considering what do they charge for a visit?
$5? $5?
Well, $5 in the 60s is not $5 now.
But yeah, it's a fortune telling Mrs.
Madame Xander, fortune teller. And we know that this is already our first relationship to Ouija. So there is a reference in Ouija to somebody who had lived in the house who was a fortune teller.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're getting, okay, this is, you know, since this is the origin, this is the fortune teller. So, yeah, it's, you know, we see the house, the little vibe, and people are at the table. And I just love the way Elizabeth Reeser stands there with the curtains and just says, let's begin. And the curtains just go, like, I got chills.
She has a great duster on. Mm-hmm. It's,
Yeah, her makeup in this movie
is really good. I mean, she's very pretty.
Yeah, but I just mean like the period style makeup, like the way that they, you know, like it just is impeccable and very period appropriate. And I think that was basically the moment when I was like, oh, I'm going to like this the first time that I saw it. And I was like, oh, yes, chills, hair up on my arm. And then we get Kate Siegel's Bouffant, which I
obsessed with it. And Sam Anderson, they are at a seance. They are trying to connect with Mary Browning, which is this man's wife.
There is no Easter egg there. Yeah, I looked up. I was like, is there a Mary Browning that maybe was related somehow to the Ouija board or something? There is not. Just this sad, sad old man trying to contact his wife.
And kind of a bitchy daughter that, you know.
Oh, yeah. You know, like you clock her character from like minute, like second one. And so, you know, you see that, you know, she's like, give us a sun. She's lighting the candles and it's all like.
Yeah, you get three questions, mood, three wishes, three questions, deny me three times. You know, we love a trio.
Yeah. And the whole time, literally any time that Elizabeth Reeser, that Madame Xander's character says anything into the ether to the spirits, Kate Siegel's character's eyes roll back even further into her head.
We love to see it.
Yes. It was amazing. I love the sass. So you find out through this seance, the three questions are you in pain? And she is not in pain anymore. She's beautiful forever now. Can you forgive me? And yes, she can. And then, you know, an apparition appears through the curtains. And like
they start. A very convenient one.
What a cool shot, though.
Yeah, it was really pretty.
And then question number three is this man, you know, legit who wants to marry our daughter? He's asking for a lot of money and says, as soon as I come up with this money and mortgage my house, he'll marry her. At which point you want to scream at the TV.
Like, no, it's a terrible idea.
No, Jenny, no. No. So, yeah. And I wrote, it's interesting how concerned you are that this is a scam, Jenny, seeing how some fly-by-night douchebag is trying to take your dad for all he's worth and then leave you at the altar.
But maybe she's, like, in on it.
I don't know.
We don't hear from Jenny again, so I didn't get that concern about
think
Jenny.
I think she wants to marry this guy. I think she's like, I want to get out of the house. I want to marry this man. Daddy, give me the money. But, just interesting that way. So then we, you know, get this jump scare, which is the apparition, like, screeching and, like, the candles all blow out and, like, everything is chaos.
This man is clutching his chest like he's in Gerald's Game.
I was like, oh, no, we're going to have a seance for this man. So we cut to the man and his daughter leaving abruptly. He goes to pay her and she says, no, I can't take it. Just remember that she is at peace now. And they drive off with one last death glare from Jenny.
Classic Jenny.
It's interesting to note, you know, just at this point in the Blu-ray commentary, Mike Flanagan says that his visual references for the film were The Exorcist, The Changeling, Poltergeist and Watcher in the Woods.
Mm-hmm.
And so definitely you see a lot of them already kind of starting to appear, even just in that first iconic scene. So we're back inside and Mom's real mad.
Yeah. And it's revealed that the apparition is her older daughter, Paulina, known as Lena.
Who is sorry, not sorry. And we see, like, she starts to kind of rip open, like, the table and the things, and we start to see the mechanisms that they are using for the seance in order for it to be phony. And an interesting thing to note, those were all the mechanisms by which they were actually functioning during the scene. So, like, when the candles were blowing out, like, that was a person, like, actually not necessarily hiding in the same place that, you know, the younger daughter was. But there were literally pipes blowing out those candles. Interesting to note that when you blow out a candle that is burning, the hot wax blows up at you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
good to know. Good to know.
The actors did have to watch out. So anyway, moving on. So the older daughter, Lena, is saying, like, Mom, like, you know, like, this is a scam. Like, what are we doing? And, you know, the younger daughter's like, Doris is like, what do you mean this is a scam?
Well, I think Paulina says that it's like getting really, really tired. Mm-hmm. And I think Jenny had said it was a scam.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And Doris, the younger daughter, basically asked because she doesn't understand why this woman would think it was a scam. Because, like, we're really helping them, like, talk to these people, right?
Mm-hmm. And you know, she says, we tell the truth. We just do it with some showmanship, right? We do the fake seance so that they believe what is really the truth. And the, you know, I think it's Lena that says, well, if, you know, it's you're being objective and you're just trying to give them peace, why did you blow out the last candle?
So blow out the last candle, meaning
the scam. Like, yeah. Don't do it.
Yeah. I think it's in this scene that we also find out that their father has passed away, right?
Yes, because she, you know, she's like, we need this money. Like, how are we going to pay the bills, you know, with your dad gone? So then, you know, it's later in the day, I'm assuming, in the timeline. Doris, who is one of us, is falling asleep watching a
Lizzie Borden movie. Could you find what movie this was? Was this an Easter egg?
To be honest, I did not look that one up, but I didn't recognize it. I was hoping you would.
I tried looking for it. I couldn't find it. I went on a wild ride, so I assumed it was in the extended features or something.
He didn't mention it. Do you think it's an Angels with Dirty Faces situation? Do you think they made a movie within a movie, like what they did in Home Alone?
Well, if they did, then that'll be the next Mike Flanagan movie. You know, like, he would have done that, like the full Midnight Mass treatment.
Maybe we have to – he hasn't asked me anything open at the top of his Tumblr. Maybe we should go and ask him.
I mean, please, let's do it.
I might. So anyway, they're doing bedtime prayers and Doris is praying to her late father.
Not God.
Nope. And why doesn't Ghost Daddy, with the daddy again, here we go. Why doesn't Ghost Daddy talk to us? So, you know, she's just like, well, you know, he does. It's just, you know, you can't always hear him, and like, what a saccharine kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like a saccharine non-answer that she gives her. So then she's saying goodnight to Lena through the door because Lena's a sassy-ass teenager and is...
She refuses to open the door. But the real reason...
She's on her way out the window.
She's going to sneak out. I have a note. Do you notice two specific things? That she has a doll on her nightstand. Mm-hmm. And also she conveniently has a photo next to the doll of her and her father and the doll. It's a little tidy. Did you notice the photo?
I mean, it comes back later. So, yes, yeah. I noticed it at that point where it's like, proof of
life. On my second reading, I was like, ooh, someone really went in on this. Like, pay attention to this.
I mean, you have to create a visual vocabulary, and this is what they're doing. It's Ouija 2, Michelle.
Excuse me. It's Ouija Origin of Evil. It's not my mistake. Ouija 2. Wow.
My mistake. Sorry, Hasbro and Blumhouse. For let it be known in the minutes. So anyway, Lena's out the window. She's going to see her drinking friends who are going to not talk about drinking.
Yeah, they're going to have coffee. Their parents smell of coffee. They're just having coffee.
Yes. She went out to have coffee with her friends. In the meantime, we do get a little cutaway because we really need to truly establish that they are broke. And
they are broke as hell.
They are broke and they have a lot of final notice bills on the table. And so then we cut back to Lena and her friends, and she, of course, you spot the box before she does because it's like on top practically with like a neon sign pointing to it. So so she's like, should we play, guys? Like, what do you think? Anybody playing Ouija board?
And yeah, and the Ellie, I think her name is, the one whose house they're in, says it's actually really scary. And that other like mousy looking bitch goes, we could just make conversation. I was like, okay, girl, I know everything about you and I don't like you, you little narc.
But she was everything in that scene because it was so funny because of her.
Yeah, I know. She's a little narc.
So they sit down and now like the lights are out and they're sitting on the floor around the Ouija board, you know, because that's the property we're dealing with here. And we're going to sell those boards. So the rules are never play alone, never play in a graveyard, always say goodbye, circle once for each player. As friends we gather, hearts are true, spirits near, we call to you. I don't remember that ever being in.
It's not. I looked at it. It's not in the game.
I was like, shit, were we playing that wrong?
I know. I never said goodbye. I would get bored and leave.
No, that's the only rule I knew. I knew that if you walk away from the board that's saying goodbye, you left the door open for the spirits.
I thought the only rule was like, don't forget the French onion dip. I feel like I was always eating potato chips with French onion dip when I was playing Ouija.
Oh my gosh.
Oh God, no, I want French onion dip. Shit.
And that's where I wrote in my notes that one friend who can't fucking deal. Because we share a brain. So, but really, there always was. Like, honestly, that's probably the most truest to the like Ouija experience. There was always that one friend that was too chicken shit that was like, we should stop.
Yeah.
So here she is. And like, I think that's where it's like Mike Flanagan just like always figures out that like truly like human identifiable.
The most human thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like the most identifiable thing for in universal thing for everybody. So they ask, what's it like on the other side? And the answer is cold. And that's when Lena starts to explain the phenomenon that we talked about earlier by which it works. And that's when we get a promposal. 1960s.
Yeah, I was about to be like, if a Ouija board is right, like that Ouija board was real and there was a ghost trying to get through, do you think that ghost was really pissed off that this hormonal boy was like taking his connection away to like ask this little ginger to the homecoming dance?
I'm pretty sure that there, if that's true, there were a lot of spirits that were just as equally pissed off because basically Ouija boards aren't used by people taking it seriously. It's all a bunch of like 15-year-olds asking people to prom.
I mean, by this merit, I took French onion dip to prom, which it's not that far off.
Maybe the ghosts were pissed off that some people were snacking, Michelle.
Sorry. It's just my metabolism. I needed a snack.
So so they ask for a sign that there's a spirit and instead they get hella busted.
Oh, yeah.
But that scared friend's scream
is really good. She's very good.
It was
wherever
everything.
You are. Yeah. Good for you. Good work.
Apparently she did it as like a goof in rehearsal and Mike Flanagan loved it. So it stayed in. So her mom comes to get her and she is pissed. You know, Doris is sleeping in the back. And
you couldn't leave this kid home? Like,
I mean, it was the 60s. They just left their kids like do it.
Yeah.
But, like, I don't know. And so in the meantime, they have like a heart to heart, like, you can't do this. We have to be responsible. You like, you know, whatever. And then she's like, yeah, but what about the Ouija board? Like, you should use that in the same conversation.
This shit is getting tired.
Yeah. Didn't I tell you your shit was getting tired? Like, let's worry about your real problems and not my problems of sneaking out at night. So the next morning, Lena's rushing out and someone's at the door.
Ooh, who could it be?
It's a boy. Mom is like, oh, you want to walk to school with Lena? Okay, well, you can walk Doris, too, so that I can go do something else.
Mm-hmm.
Go get your bags, girls. And
uh-oh.
She sits down and offers to read his palm while they wait for the girls. And so really she's reading him. She finds out.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. He's a senior and Lena is a sophomore. And she's like, oh, look at this line. Look at that line. And then the thumbnail digs into the palm.
Yeah, it's very potent.
She's like, if you use this hand to touch anything on my daughter, I will kill you, okay? Actually, she says, I'd hate to see something happen to your lifeline, you dig?
Yeah, it was good. It was very good takedown.
I was into it. So I guess presumably they all fuck off to school and Alice that's the mom's name. I have in my notes, I've just been calling her mom until now, but her name is Alice.
Alice.
She walks into a soda fountain that also has occult shit and Ouija board.
Yeah, it's really convenient. I was like, where the hell is it? I want to go there. That banana split looked really good.
It's like one-stop shopping. You mean that I could buy my tarot cards and also have a milkshake at the same time? They might have onion dip, Michelle.
They might have onion dip. I also, am I getting old and conservative that I was like, bitch, get another job. The fortune telling ain't working. Get another job. You're going to the soda fountain midday, girlfriend, spending money on this board game?
That was for work, Michelle.
Yeah, that tax write-off for that $1.99 is going to be.
But listen, I don't know if maybe you yelled that through the TV at her advice, you know, that advice to her, but in the car, she is pounding the pavement. She is circling those want ads. With that red pen.
She is
looking for that other job, receptionist, etc. You know, so she is doing it anyway.
But we do know she had the $1.99 to buy.
She did buy the Ouija board.
The Ouija board
and some candles. So we see that she is waiting outside of the school for Doris,
which I have two things about. Number one, it's a Catholic school, so you're spending more money on their school. Send them to public school if you're so hard on money.
I thought the same thing.
And number two, you're a fortune teller that sends your kids to Catholic school? Like, that's weird, right?
I think they just needed, like, they didn't want the priest to be so isolated. So they definitely were like, what's a way to get the priest involved from the very beginning? Let him be at the school. But It does open up some other plot holes.
It really can. It's a confusing dynamic. The priest and the Catholic school in their journey seems weird. But.
Oh, for sure. So Doris is being bullied on her way out the door. Doris the Dorcas and Father Tom stops the bullies and sends them on their way, and then tries to comfort her. And that's when Alice walks over and is like, I'll take it from here. You know, this is my daughter.
But there's also like from the beginning, there's a weird smolder between Alice and that priest.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, honestly, I was like, oh, they want this to be like the little like meet cute there. Because, of course, mom witnesses him help her daughter. He like does the thing where he like gets down to her level. Mm-hmm. You know, he's talking to her, he's gentle to her, he's caring to her. Like, of course, you know, that's gonna be like a thing of like, well, hello. Yeah. And who are you? Oh, the collar.
Oh, right there. God. Right. Oh, God. Married to God.
Very Thornbirds. So Doris suggests that they invite Father Tom over for a reading to talk to his pre-priesting wife.
Pre-priesting?
Who is dead.
And Elizabeth Reiser, you can see her just mentally putting that on her notes app, whatever the 1967 equivalent of the notes app. It would be a notepad, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. But like, oh.
So you were married. Oh.
So you know how to sling that thing if the push comes to shove. That's exactly what Elizabeth Reiser was thinking.
Michelle.
I am.
That is a man of the cloth. Huh. So, and that's where I wrote, why the hell are they in Catholic school?
It's just, yeah, it's very confusing to me.
So, back at the house, we get this awesome shot of like the side of the vintage Ouija board box where it says like Ouija, like it tells all or whatever it is. And Ouija knows. How about I read my notes? Ouija knows all the answers.
But for those at home, Dina did do a nice little like Music Man Harold Hill arm when she said it instead of looking at her notes.
Improv. So anyway, it took a half a day to get this shot that like turned sideways and whatnot. So you see that Alice is engineering the Ouija board to work without her hands. She's got this whole thing like rigged up on her legs with like magnets, and she's using metallic paint on the bottom of the planchette. And it's like, why is she circling receptionist jobs and waitress jobs when she's already an engineer?
Yeah, no.
Like looking for the wrong jobs. So yeah. So, you know, she's...
We have so much advice about how this woman could be doing her life better in her last few days of life.
This is a fictional woman who dies at the end of this movie. So anyway, so she's like, okay, practicing, you know, right? She's doing this for fakesies. Is anyone here? But in the meanwhile, Doris is like upstairs in a completely different room and responds, Marcus... And Lena notices, but, like, isn't alarmed by it at all. Like, just kind of, like...
She's a teenager. She's thinking about necking with Mikey.
Yeah, like, was she, like, painting her nails or something? She's doing something. Homework, painting her nails, whatever. And she's, like, she kind of notices that she's talking to herself. And, you know, then it's like, can you hear me? And Doris responds, yes, we can hear you and see you. And now, at that point, if I'm Lena, like, I'm saying something about that. But she says nothing. So... Back to, you know, Alice, she's trying to reach out to Roger, her husband. Honey, are you there? But it doesn't work. So she gets up, she leaves the room, and as soon as she leaves the room,
it goes to no.
Mm-hmm. And that's when Doris sneaks into the seance room and is like, well, I'm here. And the board spells out, hi, friend, on its own. And Doris says, hi, friend. Now what? So hi, friend is a big plot point of
the first movie.
First Ouija. And so basically the spirits in this same house, because the Ouija movie takes place in the same house, but present day, the board keeps spelling that out to everyone who dies.
And they start seeing it everywhere.
Yeah, it starts getting carved into shit and whatnot. Here, it basically doesn't go much further than when Doris talks to it. So, yeah. And Doris does the planchette to her eye move, which also was kind of from the first movie.
Is that like a thing, though? I never did that. Like,
neither did I.
That's created for this movie, right?
I don't know. Maybe there's just a whole lot of... We were like... How old were you when you were using the Ouija board? Like, I was a kid.
Like 10. I don't know.
Did I actually read the instructions? Probably not. Maybe no. It did say something about it and I wasn't paying attention. I haven't... I've been looking for it. I can't find my Ouija board. Ooh, scary.
Ooh.
So anyway, she looks through it. So she sees something, but we can't see it. And she asks, whatever it is, who are you? So then it's nighttime and Lena is asleep and we get the classic ghosty blanket pull.
Yeah. Flanagan, you crazy SOB, you love a blanket pull.
Who does? I mean, it's in so many movies. And that's
yeah,
like,
I know.
He really does love, especially in this, to do things that like reference scares from those kinds of classic movies that he grew up with, that we also grew up with.
Well, and practical effects. Like uh-huh. A lot of practical. It's a practical effect.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's effective.
Mm-hmm. It's a low budget, high payoff, you know, scare. So Lena thinks it's Doris. She looks to the end of the bed, but there's no one there. And that's pretty much all we get of that little vignette. So Alice pulls up to school, fixing her hair.
Yeah, I was about to say, hoisting her boobs up practically. Go see a man of God.
For her meeting with Father Tom. So she's having her little meeting with Father Tom in his office. It's nothing untoward. They're just sitting at a table. But I feel like we're going to have to make all of this sound like, ooh.
Ooh.
Ooh, she likes the priest. So he's asking, you know, Alice, are you helping Doris with her homework? And she's like, no, because
she's really embarrassed. Like, no, I'm too busy with my magnetic paint. I'm too busy attaching like magnets to my vagina. I'm too busy. Fuck this kid.
So he says, so she says no, but the penmanship is definitely an adult who went to Catholic school, but not Doris.
I know. It was like, well, then she did. The incredulity of them being like, well, she hasn't learned cursive. And I was like, I think I was learning cursive by it's her
Catholic
age.
Catholic school. That's all they do is learn cursive, right? Cursive and Jesus. So in the car, after this meeting, Doris like freely admits that she let a spirit or entity take use of her hand. And nobody like it's just a non-issue. It's like, okay, cool.
I mean, honestly, I hated math so much. If literally the devil himself came next to me during like while I was doing algebra homework and was like, you want me to do that? I'd be like, all right, take whatever you need. I don't want to do remainders. I don't need that in my life.
Well, I mean, I guess that's what Doris is doing too. So
yeah, I can't fault Doris. Game knows game.
I'm not faulting Doris, but if that happened and you told your mom that the devil did your math homework, would she be fine with that?
No, I would be out with the dog that we adopted out on the streets of Georgia.
Oh my god.
Oh no, we did not adopt. Fostered.
Oh man. Ooh, Freudian slip.
Ay, ay, ay.
So when they get to the door, there is a foreclosure notice on the door. And so after dinner, they've probably been having the most depressing dinner ever where it's like, oh, we're losing our house.
Oh my god, it was just like SpaghettiOs, just like cold SpaghettiOs.
So yeah, after dinner, they finish dinner, they're eating their little sad dinner. Doris wants to tell Dad the bad news, so she gets up and grabs the Ouija board. And again, nobody is saying anything. They're just
It's the 60s. They were just thinking about cigarettes.
They're just letting all of this happen. So on the porch, Alice and Lena are like having this like very serious conversation, grappling with what to do. You know, I don't want to lose this house. If there's anything of him left, he's here. He's in these walls. And they kind of talk about Doris not really understanding what's happened. Like he never came home. And it's kind of like she's just like, all right, well, he's still somewhere. And in the meanwhile, in the back, we get this like creepy like glimpse of like Doris is looking for something. She's like patting her little feet like on the floor. Mm-hmm.
Just like she's gone down to the basement.
Mm-hmm. She's like going to all these different shadowy places and like they're still talking. And so then Doris comes up to them and just hands Alice a wad of cash from inside the walls and says, Daddy told me this was there.
I mean, good for Daddy. Good for Daddy. Spoiler alert, it's not Daddy, which confuses me actually more. Is it the father?
It's not.
No, but like the backstory, even with a genius like Mike Flanagan, gets me a little confused about who is who. I'm not gonna lie.
Well, we'll get there. We'll discuss that as we get to that part.
But anyway, that's a lot of SpaghettiO money that they have.
So Doris tries to show them how to use the Ouija board to talk to their father/husband. And like Lena is watching this and now finally she is not cool with it. And the planchette moves to say he's here. Alice asks a question that only Roger could know the answer to. She asks, where was he when she told him that she was pregnant with Lena? And the planchette moves on its own and spells out shower.
Which apparently is correct and is also really weird. And we're just not going to – no one asked any follow-up questions about that.
No, they will not be taking additional questions at this time. So the planchette's like moving on its own. And then she says, look, I can even see the spirits through the planchette sometimes. And they're like, okay, lady, like what are you – okay.
Yeah, no. You know. Would be absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. So after she says that she can see the spirits going through the planchette, right – they cut away and mm-hmm. we see Lena looking at Doris while she's asleep.
Oh yeah. And they're like talking about like, oh,
right.
Like, maybe she is the real deal.
Yes. So the sound starts to bleed in from the scene that we're going to cut to while she's viewing Doris sleeping and like looking kind of suspiciously at her, like, what is your deal? But they do this weird camera pan where the shot goes from like just like sideways to tilting up. It's a 90 degree tilt.
Yeah.
And apparently it's an in-joke that Mike Flanagan has with Michael Fimignari that they now put in almost everything that they do. So we're going to have to start looking as we go through all of their stuff for that shot, because when they work together, they see it as like a challenge to try to put it in.
It does seem like it's a little out of place.
Mm-hmm. And they just basically find somewhere for it to go every time.
Huh, all right. Yeah. Good to know.
Yeah. It's like their little in-joke with each other. So Alice is like 100% convinced that it's Roger and this is real. And Doris is a medium and her mother was a fortune teller. And I know I'm not, but maybe it skips a generation. Like, she is just self-talking herself into like, this is
the real thing.
And, you know, Lena's just like, this is wild. Like, you have to listen. This cannot be reality. You're buying into this so quickly. Like, stop.
Yeah, like, this is a really weird production of Gypsy. Like, calm down.
Yeah, slow your roll. So, you know, Alice is like, listen, you can say whatever you want, but, like, what about this money? I'm taking this to the bank in the morning. I knew your father would take care of us.
Okay.
Very dramatic. So now Lena looks through the planchette and sees a dark figure in the corner of the frame, which is very Flanagan.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not, like, is it there? Is it, and, like, just, like, does that quick thing where it's just, like,
yeah, that's
off to the side. So in the commentary, Flanagan says that he hates using the jump scare. But especially the thing he hates the most about it is when it has to be accompanied by this, like, dramatic musical sting. So a lot of the jump scares that he put in here, they are still like a jump, but they like he tried to avoid adding the sting wherever he could. So yeah, you'll notice there's a lot of stuff he does with the sound where he like takes that sound out, because if you're going to jump from something moving, then that's going to be the only thing that's there.
Yeah, and the music is very subdued in this movie.
Mm-hmm. It was done by the Newton brothers, who he works with a lot. So they definitely have a shorthand and like kind of like know what he wants. But the music was also heavily influenced by like the Poltergeist score and a lot of other scores from that time. Like, they really did have a very strict list of like what he was looking for. So Lena is in school the next day. She's walking with Mikey.
Good old Mikey.
You know, he's like paying attention to her and like looking at her like she hung the moon, and she's still checking to see if he's still interested in going to homecoming with her.
Or if that was the ghost.
You know. And so he is about to kiss her, but he is cock blocked by Father Tom.
Classic. That's why you pay that big money. That's why she's paying that money for that cock blocking.
To make sure that someone's telling them, not a lot of room for the Holy Ghost, is there? You know, save room for Jesus. Yeah, so we cut to Father Tom's office, where now he's with Lena, and Lena thinks that she's getting in trouble because a boy tried to kiss her. And he's like, no, yes, boys do need discouragement, you know, like, keep that penny between your knees, girl. But actually, I am checking about your sister. She's been out of school for 4 days. Where has she been? What's going on? So now we basically have it revealed to us that, like, the delusion has taken over, like, Doris and Alice. Like, they're both at home playing with the Ouija board, not going to school.
But also, like, she couldn't call in and be like, say she was sick or something.
Nope, couldn't even, because that's literally what, they get up and probably get on that Ouija board.
Is the Ouija board addictive?
I don't know. I think that they just need to be there. They're so into it. They're super into it now. They're eating their meals.
They're eating their SpaghettiOs.
They're eating their
over the Ouija board.
Over the Ouija board, just like your onion dip. So meanwhile, we see that they're back at home. We see exactly what we just said was happening, minus the SpaghettiOs. Mm-hmm, and they're back at the Ouija board. They're at the table. They're trying to contact Roger. And so we get the sixth sense. I ask, do I make her proud? And Doris says, always in a man's voice. And then we cut to the ending of a reading with another satisfied customer, this woman who wants to come back tomorrow. And I said, girl, how many dead people do you need to contact?
Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, $5 a pop, a lot. I hope she raised her prices when she got new props.
Oh, I'll bet you she did. She probably was like, well, the Ouija board is like 25 cents extra. I don't know. I don't understand inflation.
I was about to say, you want me to ask Alexa what 25 cents in today's money is?
So, you know, now it's nighttime. Doris is asleep. She wakes
up. But her neck hurts.
Yeah, she wakes up with that neck pain. And just Lena just hands her some Tylenol and was like, go to bed.
Yeah, that's real. It's real 60s parenting, sistering.
It's the sister parent. We have Lena as sister parent now. And so, you know, instead of like going back and resting and laying down and trying to feel better, she gets up and goes to the Ouija board and asks her dad what happened to her neck. You know.
It doesn't go well.
No. So this time she again takes the planchette and now she's looking around with it. And we do get the sound jump scare and then the shadow jump scare. And and she looks in the mirror and she lifts the planchette to the mirror and she sees the demonic figure. And he basically like reaches like into her mouth and like backbends her.
Yeah.
And yeah, she did that whole stunt on the like on a wire, like they bent her back.
Oh wow, like that. Good That's, for her.
Yeah, that was a practical effect. So yeah, and then we see scary-eyed Doris whispering into Lena's ear as she sleeps. The scary eyes that go white, like I don't know.
Yeah, I don't like it.
I don't like it.
I also do. We ever find out what she is whispering?
No.
Like this bit, this like spirit is constantly whispering in people's ears. Like he needs to have a stage whisper.
I think that's from the, I don't remember. No, it wasn't from the first one.
I don't think it is.
No, but they do say that like the spirit tells you things in the original, like that whole line of like, they'll tell you amazing and horrible things. Like that's from the first movie.
Oh, okay.
So, so we see the whispering has now, the demonic whispering has now begun. So Lena now hears the creepy whispering. She's like at her mirror in the bathroom, and then her like lips start to disappear.
Yeah, it's really weird,
but it's all a nightmare, right? But I mean, the lips being sealed or sewn shut again is a callback to the original,
to the first movie,
right? The first movie, they like that starts to happen to a lot of the teenagers, or I guess they're college age kids, whatever. To me, they're teens. They seem young. So they're there, and like eventually you see that the like corpse that they find is sewed shut as well by the mouth. So you know that's a through line from the original movie. So now we're with Doris on the playground. She's just zoning out because now
she's being real creepy.
And the bully boys are aiming a slingshot at her, and she stares at them and carries them. The slingshot turns.
Mm-hmm. And the sound, you don't really see it, but the sound is really gross.
Oh, you hear it. You hear everyone screaming. People start running. You know, and it is PG-13, so obviously all of that stuff, they have to pan away. Like, anytime something, like, violent, vicious, or gory happens, we don't see any of that.
Mm-hmm.
So now Alice is dressed up to go out.
With whom?
I wonder. So she's meeting up with Father Tom and Little Thornbird's dinner. And she's sitting there with him at the table after they leave. And she's like, some nights I don't even heat up the SpaghettiOs.
I also have a question. Who paid for dinner for this date?
Well, did you notice she's, like, eating lobster?
Yes, I have it in my notes, too. Is this going to be one of those things where, like, you hope, like, you go to dinner with, like, your rich friend's parents and you're, like, you just hope they're going to pay because you can't really figure it out, you know?
What like, he's a priest. What if he, like, he doesn't have a ton of money? Like, they take a vow of poverty in addition. Like, she's just ignoring all his vows. She ignores the vow of chastity. Now she's, like, ignoring the vow of poverty. He's going to say, let's go Dutch. What's she going to do?
But also it's like, oh, I wanted to discuss the kids, not in front of them. So you chose the restaurant that you took your dead wife to?
You chose the most romantic spot you could find.
There are red flags here.
Flags on the field. No, but on, or wait a second. Is it all of the wall money? And she's like, I'm having lobster. I don't care if we go Dutch.
She got to pay for her house.
I don't listen. I don't know the rules of ghost money. It's fine.
I still don't even understand. It was all like 20s in there. I also don't understand. It doesn't look like old enough money for where it ends up being.
It was the 60s. People bought their houses for like $12 in the Sears catalog. Isn't that how that happened?
Anyway.
So in the interim, while they're having this like romantic dinner that's like not supposed to be a romantic dinner and they're ordering foods they can't afford. Meanwhile, Mikey is showing up at their house at the
and, classic.
And about to, you know, go hang out with Lena in her bedroom. But now we cut back to the restaurant, and not only is he trying to talk to her about the kids, but he's also lecturing her about meddling in the occult. So
yeah, like, so you took her to a romantic restaurant to lecture her? It's mm-hmm. it's very confusing yes. to me.
And Alice is still not reading the room because now she's offering that she could help him talk to his wife again. Like, what a threesome that would be. So
I mean, honestly, maybe it would be a fun time for everyone.
Who knows? So, but then we get that like poignant, like Mike Flanagan writing, you know, there are so many things that, you know, you probably didn't get to say to her. And he says, yeah, there are a lot of things I didn't get to say, but I like to think that the things I didn't say, she already knows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what, you know, still, even in the middle of Ouija 2, where she's ordering lobster and where are they getting the money?
I was about to say, in the middle of this poignant thing, you hear her cracking the lobster.
You know, this movie's off the rails, and so are we. So they start sharing like memories of their lost loved ones, and you know, she's kind of like seeing like, oh, we're like bonding, and like I think he starts to look up finally and realize, oh, she's like into me, like she's flirting. She thinks we have something going here. So he kind of shuts her down. And so they toast to another life. Maybe mm-hmm. in another life, you know, we could have been something. So
and then they divide the check and leave.
And they're like, so would you like to split this? Like, or would you like to pay for what you order? I will say this, though. Mike Flanagan acknowledged in the commentary that he knew he was pushing the envelope with having this conversation between this widowed woman and a priest mm-hmm. and like skirting the idea of like flirtation and interest in a relationship, and was flabbergasted that they allowed all of this. You know, I think with a lot of things that he did add to the film that like we're noting of like actual poignant things and real things, he was pushing an envelope and they really did just support and allow those things to happen.
I mean, priests are allowed to flirt. They just can't like, yeah, really.
This is like a PG-13 movie that's like just meant to scare a bunch of teenagers who, you know, went to the movie theater to throw popcorn at any generic screen. And they're really allowing him to do some serious stuff. And like, I think he knew what the expectation was, and then how he was not necessarily going that route. And they were all fine with that. So, and you know, just an interesting note there. So we're now back to the house. You know, Mikey is with Lena in her bedroom, and you know, I don't think that Alice has much to worry about. This kid's just obsessed with the house.
Yeah, like, keeps talking about the bones of the house, which is
this house has good bones. My dad's a real estate agent. It's like, he's not trying to get into her pants. He's trying to get into the lease.
The only bones he is really concerned with, not his own, the ones downstairs and the ones in the walls.
So he does finally lean in for a kiss. And this time, Father Tom is too busy buying platonic lobster for Alice. So
platonic lobster.
So they have this kiss. But now apparently the kiss was borrowed from Rear Window. Mike Flanagan says that the shot that centers around the kiss in Rear Window is the most perfect screen kiss of all time. And he replicated it.
I guess it is. I wouldn't even thought about it.
Even down to like slowing down the frame rate when the actual kiss happens and even down to the camera rotation when they break away, it is essentially a recreation of that sequence. And there is a Rear Window poster in her room.
Yeah, she has some good posters in there, I've noticed. Yeah.
So after the kiss, he heads downstairs to leave. She's like, you know what? You need to go. And there is a cut scene where her friend is talking to her about Mikey and like whatever. And she's like, so have you kissed him yet? And like she like looks down and like gets really like flustered. And she's like, have you kissed anybody yet? And like it's apparent in the cut scene that she hasn't. So, like, this is, like, her first kiss. She's probably like, okay, you know what? Like, this is moving too fast for me. Like, you need to go.
I mean, I feel like it read even without the scene.
Yeah, but I mean, that it is part of that. Like, that's the reason why that's there. Like, that was all part of that conversation because they filmed it.
And Mikey's flying high. He's checking out the beams of the house. And he goes downstairs. And Doris is there to kill his good bones.
Yeah, and she's just standing down there like one of like the children of the corn, like hi there, just like waiting for him. And and that's when we get the "Do you know what it feels like to be strangled to death" speech. She auditioned with this.
This was like everyone auditioned with it, or she auditioned with this?
I believe they saw a lot of people who did. I don't know if every candidate did, but this is what she walked in with. And she basically performed it the exact way that it's filmed.
And which is good.
Yeah, Mike Flanagan pointed out that most of the other actors who came in and did this speech all went with like trying to be scary and like morose and dark, and she came and did that whole like very like nonchalant like and like this that little like kind of smirk about it, and that he felt like this is just the best thing ever. And this particular take is her first take.
God damn, good for her.
This is her first take as per the commentary. You know, and she talks about the pressure in your throat and your eyes water and all. Like, I basically just wrote down the entire thing because not only is her performance good, but obviously the writing is also fucking
is really very
bone chilling.
It's the most like Mike Flanagan like monologue that I think you get in this movie.
Mm-hmm. And like, it's just, it's scary. Like, it's just really, really scary. And, you know, so after she's like, okay, you know, like that's cool. All
right. Good night, Romeo. Yep. Where like, which is also, that's what they just talked about in the bedroom. So, like, it's mm-hmm. also, like, how does she,
right,
she
like,
know?
How does she know? And then she goes back to smiling at what's on the TV, but it's fucking static.
Yeah.
And he's just like, gotta go, bye.
Gotta go, bye.
He, like, runs off. You know, so then we cut to, you know, another day, and Doris is, like, sitting on her floor, like, writing, like, scribbling on this paper, all work and no play, makes Doris a dull boy. And the doll's mouth is sewed shut.
Is it sewed or is it like it's written on to look like sewn?
I couldn't really tell, but it's messed up. And so the doll's mouth is messed up. And Lena's like, what did you do? You know, our father gave this to me. Like, how dare you? And Doris is like, but he did it. It was him. It was daddy.
Daddy.
And that's when Lena loses it. And she's just trying, you know, she's trying to fight with, you know, Alice to make her more skeptical, and, you know, this whole scene back and forth. And as a note, this is the one scene in the movie that Mike Flanagan feels like he wishes he had done differently. He talks about it in the commentary. He didn't get enough coverage. They were running out of time, and this scene, you know, there needed to be close-ups in his mind mm-hmm. to push in a little further, and he only had wides when he went to edit it. Because he is an editor who thinks like – he is a director who thinks like an editor. So, yeah. You know, when he's talking to the actors too, he's like, and this is what I'm going to do with it, and this is what we're going to see. And he, as an editor, is like, I wish when I sat down to edit it, I had more shots of that. So Lena says that Doris is changing, and is like, what makes you get that impression?
Yeah, like, what? She's fine. It's fine.
It's all fine. And she's like, why would her father ever do anything to change her? And so now Doris doesn't want to go to school. She just wants to stay home and talk to her friends. And we see Lena finding the papers under the bed, and she's like, oh, you know, looking at it and kind of panicking. So she goes to Father Tom, and she, you know, she's like, do you know anybody who can read Polish? Because this isn't another language, and I think it's Polish.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I think there's a nun that came here after the war. And also, would you tell your mother that she owes us $15 for the lobster?
Oh, my God. What a callback, Michelle.
Listen, I have a skill. It's not research.
So it was a real diary entry that she showed Father Tom. Like, that was actually Mike Flanagan wrote it. It was translated into Polish. Because he was afraid that someone like me,
like us crazy people,
but someone who could read Polish, like me who reads Polish, would pause it. And he was like afraid. So he's ready. Like, he's anything I'm going to do, anything I'm going to pause or look up.
No, he's there.
He's already 10 steps ahead of me. Mikey Flan. No, Mikey Flan.
Cut it.
So then we get Father Tom pulling up to the house, and that really cool shot where the camera goes through both windows of the car, and then we get the exorcist shot of mm-hmm. Father Tom standing with his briefcase outside next to the egregiously large fortune teller sign.
So large.
So this was the second take of that shot. They weren't sure that they were going to be getting any, like, getting it to work, because literally Henry Thomas had to pull the car up to the exact right spot, had to get out at a certain timing. The camera had to fit through both of those windows and keep going on the track. Like, everything had to work right. So he wasn't sure it was going to happen, but it did. That was shot two. It is unenhanced, and he's very proud of it. So anyway, Father Tom is now in the house and
playing mind games.
Mm-hmm, he asks to take Alice up on the reading. And so now they're at the Ouija board. It's Alice, Father Tom, and Doris at the Ouija board. And they call out to his dead wife, Gloria, and the board moves on its own. And so it's like, ooh, are you there? Yes, darling. And then the next thing that comes out of the board is miss you. And then he says, well, okay, so if you're my wife, what's your middle name? And the board spells out Lynn. And then it starts to say, forgive. Okay, forgive you for what? You know, like, you forgive me? Yes. For what? For the fight.
And what's the fight about?
Ooh. And she says, not important. And then she starts to spell out, don't hide behind collar. Want you to be. And a woman's voice comes out of Doris's mouth, happy. So Father Tom says, you know, oh, by the way, you know, I was here for a Ouija reading and also to discuss Lena's progress in school.
What if I'm going to try one more callback. What if like it was the end of the reading and she was like, so we're even for the lobster now, right? That's it. No more lobster references. No more SpaghettiOs.
So yeah, so Father Tom is like, Lena has gotten in trouble at school and I need to talk to you alone right now. So, you know, they head upstairs and, you know, they're like, let's shut the door, make sure this kid can't, because Doris is like, I want to come. And Father Tom's like, no, not you. You're the reason why it's private. So anyway, so he says, you know, are you sure? You're sure she wrote these pages? And Lena says, yes. And he goes, okay, well, I just want to say, first off, my wife's middle name is Catherine. And Alice's reaction is like, so you were unhappy with your reading?
I don't have the money.
Listen, these things happen like this, you know, because he says, it was my mother's middle name that was Lynn. She goes, well, a medium can make those mistakes. Maybe she was like, she's ready to like explain away the reasons why the reading was inaccurate. And he admits, no, I was trying to trick her. I thought the name Lynn, like, as hard as I could, I repeated it over and over in my head because, you know, like, there are tricksters and we have to watch for them. And he quotes the Bible. And, you know, he broke down exactly what Doris was doing, you know, and basically saying that it was a cold reading. So then Alice is continuing to get offended that he's accusing Doris of being John Edwards. And he goes, no, I think she's the real deal. I think that the like there's a demon or something that
like
was
a real creepy deal.
Like there is a demon cold reading me. You know, like she's not a fraud, but she's not what we think she is either. So Doris is downstairs demoning at the TV.
My note said, like, as the doorbell rings, no one in that bedroom hears the doorbell.
And so it is our friend Mikey.
Oh, poor Mikey.
Poor Mikey. He's arriving at the house because, you know, he wants to do an inspection.
He wants to see the bones.
He wants to see the bones. And he's gonna.
And he's gonna see the bones.
And he's gonna see them. So, you know, she opens the door for him and she tells him to wait here. You know, and she, and he's like,
if I opened the door and that child was there, I'd be like, I will see you later.
Well, he's trying to leave, though. He's like, you know what? I think I'll come back. Like, he does, exactly. He's actually one of the people that probably in a horror movie mostly at least will think about doing the logical thing, like what you just said. And so he tries to leave, but she insists that there's treasure in the walls and that she's going to show him. And he's like, well, that's going to really, you know, increase the appraisal rate. So we got to do this. So he's like, what? So he follows her downstairs. So they go down. So now the next sequence that happens is two separate scenes that are literally overlapping with one another. And he wrote these scenes complete in the script. They each exist separately in the screenplay, mm-hmm. and then he had to explain to the production company that it was going to be cross-cut later, because mm-hmm. it was a little bit of a sell, because they told him that the scene with Father Tom was way too long. And they were like,
I mean, it is a lot, like, it's a lot of pages, right. A lot of backstory for right. our little
it's
Marcus.
It's a long sequence, but he's like, but it's not going to feel as long because it's going to be cross-cut with this other thing that's happening. Like, that shorter scene is happening, you know, back and forth. So anyway, Sister Hannah had translated the journal from Marcus, who grew up in Poland during World War II. And, you know, his family got rounded up by the Germans during the invasion. And so the devil's doctor experimented on the patients and an interest in the occult, which all is like very like, there are stories like that are similar yeah. to that. They used kind of one for American Horror Story a little bit. That's basically this story yeah. from Asylum.
Oh, and it's what's the there's the Hulu show about Nazi hunters, and that has like a Dr. Death sort of Nazi situation.
Oh yeah, maybe. I'm not so familiar with that one, but I know I definitely recognize this one from, this is a Ryan Murphy shit right here. So in the meantime, yeah, let's just do one at a time. So we got the story, right? The doctor, you know, is experimenting on them using the occult. They're rescued by the Allies. But when they end up in a mental hospital in the States, they recognize the doctor is here but with a different name. And the doctor kind of gets him out, brings Marcus home to his house that has a secret room for the experiments. And they
always a secret room.
Yep. Does all sorts of bad things to these patients, and then says this, the creepiest thing, which is he describes his own murder and then everything that happens after. So,
and Lena is like, what?
What? So then in the meantime, while that's happening, we see that Doris is leading the boy into the basement. The Oculus mirror is in the corner of the back where they're walking mm-hmm. in that little section. So explaining, oh, the money was here and there's probably a little more, maybe some jewelry. You know, and she's like, I put some of it back, like maybe like, you know, put your hand through this hole and see
yeah,
what happens.
Never a good idea.
Nope. And so he pulls out a doctor's bag that has Gerald's ear. No, I'm just kidding.
oh, God.
Could you imagine that Easter egg?
Maybe they brought the prop from one to the other, well, honestly.
They could have. I mean, this was filmed first, but yeah. maybe that is the same doctor's bag. I don't know, because there were no special features for Gerald's game. Thanks, Netflix. In the doctor's bag, there are ID cards that belong to these people. So, yeah. there's the realization now in the conversation that Alice and Father Tom and Lena are having that anything that Alice had been asking the spirit, whomever she thought it was, had happened while they were living in the house. So they were there to witness it, which means they can see them now and they should probably stop.
Everyone should just shut up.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And Father Tom is like, well, the Vatican would have to, you know, remove.
Yeah, suddenly he becomes like an upright priest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, going back to Good Bones and the other story that we're seeing, and after finding the medical bag and the ID cards, now Mikey finds a skull and Doris begins to demon whisper into his ears.
And, yeah, so, not going well. Mm-hmm. Poor Mikey.
So now they're looking for Doris because they're like, okay, it's been a while. Let's go check on her. We can't talk about anything anyway, so let's figure this out. And they hear banging. And this is when the boy drops down hanging by his neck, which is the exact same spot in the house that the first character that dies in the original Ouija drops down from that exact same.
But with Christmas lights.
Right.
The boy meaning Mikey, just to make sure we're being clear.
Yes. Mikey's dropping down hanging by his neck. So they're like, we have to find your sister. Like, where is she? And that's when we start hearing the little creepy music through the floorboards. They all agree to go to the basement. They try to tell Lena to stay, but she's like, no, I'm not.
But you know what pisses me off? They get down there. They have long matches, not one flashlight.
Hmm.
No one wants to bring a flashlight?
They didn't go down prepared, that's for sure. They just went running.
No.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But Alice does say that they're going to be burning that Ouija board in the furnace. So maybe they thought that the source of light was going to be the burning Ouija board?
Maybe.
I don't know. So they say that they're going to stick together, but then they get down there and they're like, let's split. Oh, no. Like, let's split up. And they say, no, that's a stupid idea. And Mike Flanagan said that that was him reminding himself while he was writing not to let them split up. So they're looking for Doris, and now the lights go out, and they throw the Ouija board into the furnace. And as they strike a match, they see the skull, and they scream.
Yeah, mm-hmm. not a great time. That's going to really hurt the selling price of that house.
And Mike Flanagan says he wishes that we could have seen more of, like, the prop skulls and skeletons and stuff, because they did put like torture appliances on the prop skeletons, but it was a little dark and a little hard to see that, and also very quick, but they were there, and I would love to see. Listen, maybe on Tumblr there are some pictures. I couldn't find any, but I gotta just dig deeper. So they laid another match, and it's like the Paris catacombs inside those walls, and that's when they have that realization of like, oh crap, we played in a graveyard.
Ooh. So, I mean, that sounds like fun to me. Mm-hmm. But
so the board starts to catch fire. And I read somewhere, or I heard somewhere, because I did look up a lot of stuff about Ouija boards. One of like the, not necessarily like hard rules, but a recommendation was don't burn the board.
Like, what? The recommendation for what? Not like, getting killed?
I don't know. Just like from the the nebulous they who whoever held the patent at some point suggested to do not burn the Ouija board. I don't know why. Maybe they used to use something that was highly flammable.
Oh, I see. It wasn't like the spirits are going to get you. It's like you're going to singe your eyebrows off.
It could be that too. I don't really I don't make the rules. I don't know. So they hear a call for help, and so Father Tom starts to crawl through the crawl space that brings him into the secret lab, and that's where we find the phonograph playing Goodbye, Little Girl, Goodbye.
A 1904 hit.
Mm-hmm. And it's a public domain song because of that being from 1904.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the surgical instruments are laid out there, and Doris is now, like, full-blown possessed. And it's like, and this, you know, now channeling all these spirits. It's like, all you get the many voices at once, you know, like the Exorcist style, like, that's where we died, like all the little voices. And And so Father Tom tries the power of prayer, but Doris just launches at him. So
nah, bro.
Yeah, he never studied to be an exorcist. He didn't think that that was going to be part of his job description because
he was married during that class.
He was too busy being married. He took the like mail away course for priesting. Uh-huh. You know,
he took the online courses, but it was just two tin cans and a dream.
So he comes back through the crawl space, you know, and you know, like, you think he's fine and whatever. And they're like, oh, okay, what's up? And he's like, she's part of the one. No, he's possessed. Yeah,
and he's not fine.
Because,
spoiler,
possession,
he's not fine.
Possession is contagious when you, like, you think about, like, the rules of possession in other movies. Like, that is a thing that happens. But, like, it's just very, like, all someone has to do is whisper into your ear here. And that's like, boom, you're possessed too. So he says she's part of the walls now, and she told me, call back to the original movie, the most wonderful, awful things. And so Father Tom is now full-blown possessed, chasing Lena and Alice. They get upstairs. Lena gets to the front door, but it's locked. Alice is able to kind of pull him out of his possession. Like, she says his name, and he becomes unpossessed for a second, like, long enough to recognize, like, oh, no, I'm...
Oh, shit.
And,
yeah,
like,
I gotta
locks
cut this
the
off.
Door. Like, he tries to protect her. So he locks that basement door with himself behind it. I'm like, I'm going to protect you from myself if I have to. And then Doris is on the ceiling, and she's like a screaming demon.
I kept singing to myself, oh, what a feeling when Doris is on the ceiling. I made myself crack up.
I love it. That's a
thank you.
It's amazing. So he falls down when she like she's like, ah! And he falls down the stairs, hits his head on the step. Yep. He's gone now. Bye bye, Father Tom.
He doesn't get like a nice little, his wife doesn't come to get him.
No.
That's when he dies. Very sad.
So now there's laughing from the basement, and the Ouija board is back on the table in the reading room, which something similar happens in the original Ouija as well. Like, she does try to destroy the board, or she throws it out because the grandma's like, get rid of this board. And so she listens, and then it's like back.
Well, and it is the old, and that's the same one.
Right.
It's the same exact board.
Yeah.
It's like an old one.
Mm-hmm. So Alice is pulled into the living room, and now randomly dead Mikey is somehow alive Mikey for a second, grabs Lena.
Like he is on Double Dare.
He's like swinging like it's Legends of the Hidden Temple. He grabs her.
Yeah. I was like, whoa.
He grabs Lena. He pulls her to the top of the stairs. So now she's kind of smacked against like the wall and the step there. And she sees, looks down, and like, you know, Doris is creepily standing there at the bottom of the steps. And like, instead of just taking the stairs, has to crawl up the wall, up the side
Listen.
Of the wall.
This Lulu was like, I'm doing my own stunts. Just give it to me. They were like, we're saving money.
How many times can you put me on a bungee cord and make me do something? Like, she like got a kick out of all of it. So I guess maybe they did some more for her, or maybe they were just like, we got this budget. Like, what are we going to do with this wall crawling? So she's again demon whispering, and Alice is, you know, she's recovered from being dragged into the dining room, and she's at the stairs now, and she's like begging demonic Doris to let Lena go. She's like, talk to me.
Demonic Doris.
Like, talk to me. Like, talk to me instead. I take me. You know, and so, you know, Doris is now standing behind Alice, like, because apparently she can teleport when she's demonically possessed.
Well, Lulu was tired for the day. Yeah, so she didn't want to do another stunt.
Yeah, so she's behind her. She's like, we'll take all of you. Pfft, harsh blackout. Apparently there were like something like dozens of voice actors hired to all read the lines, and then they in post like mixed like what voices they want. Like they put a lot of thought into the demonic voice. So now when we you know, cut back and everything, now Alice is now in the basement, and freaky demonic Doris face is just here to stay. This is where we're at now. The white eyes.
Demonic Doris is just Doris.
Yep, this is just Doris now. Someone has carried, in the meantime, someone has carried Lena back to her bed, and it's Dad.
Daddy!
And there's a flashback to the mention of Dad trying to help that he did it. He sewed the doll's mouth shut. And that gives Lena an idea. You see like the little light bulb go off over her head. And now we're back down in the basement with Alice. She's chained up by demon Doris. And Alice,
I was like, oh no, not handcuffs.
Alice is like, I just wanted you to be able to talk to Daddy, you know, and she's saying these horrible, she's like, he's gone. He lives in the dark and the cold and he screams. And that's when Lena hits demonic Doris with a stool. So Lena hits demonic Doris with a stool and grabs the needle and thread. And then that weird wide open mouth is back.
Mm-hmm.
Did you notice the reference to the deadlights from It?
Oh, yeah, yeah, I did. When she sees, like, the little shadow in the mouth.
Yeah, it's like that little, like, glowing light, like, in the, you mm-hmm. know, down the throat. And that's when we get the one really, like, where this, if it had been an R-rated movie, we would have gotten maybe something better than this shot of her, like, just literally disappearing out of frame with the needle sewing her mouth.
Yeah, because you don't see any of it, yeah.
You know, and it does, like, you know, there was, it's just, it's like hand disappears and comes back. I don't know. It's like, I can't sit here and say, well, the way you fix that shot is, I don't know how you do. That's basically the best you can do. But
it's very kind of like, you know, you couldn't, like in Psycho, Hitchcock couldn't show the knife actually going in. Mm-hmm. So he did it with the sound and with like the downward motion.
Right, but
motion,
like what so. Sound does stitching someone's mouth closed make? So like we don't even have, like there's no way of adding anything visceral that's not visual to fix this. So it's really the one caveat from the entire movie of like where the PG-13 rating actually neuters a particular plot point.
I see what you're saying.
So it's just, it is what it is.
Okay.
So Doris wakes and she sees her dad who offers his hand. And we don't quite recognize it immediately, but she's dead.
Yeah, dead. Bye.
And this is where we get to the part that really pissed people off about the ending of Ouija Origin of Evil, because everyone was like, why did Doris have to die? And like the problem is, it was literally the one thing that Mike Flanagan couldn't change about the movie. Doris has to die in Ouija Origin of Evil.
Because that is, yeah, because it connects to the next movie.
In order for this to be a prequel, Doris has to die and has to
And the mother has to die,
And the
too.
Mother has to die as well. And her mouth has to be sewed shut as well. Like, those three things are not the only non-negotiables that he had going for him, besides, like, some names and the house. So anyway, Alice busts out of her chains without degloving.
Yeah, and I noticed that.
And discovers that Doris does not have a pulse. And, you know, Lena's like, I had to do it. I had to stop the voices, which is what, you know, Doris had said about the father and the doll. She had to stitch the mouth shut to stop the voices. So, you know, just when we think that everything is fine. And
like, we're going to settle in and eat some SpaghettiOs.
And especially because you forget that the mom has to die, too. And you forget all of Ouija because who remembers any of Ouija?
I think I remembered, but
I didn't. But so now Lena is possessed too, and she stabs Alice, and then she kind of snaps out of it and realizes what she has done. And as she's bleeding out, Alice says, "It wasn't her; it's my fault." And they say their "I love yous." And then she smiles like as she's dying because she sees Doris and Roger and Lena can't see them. And she says, everybody's waiting. And that is a 6 Feet Under reference. And the first time I watched it, I was like, wow, that's like 6 Feet Under. And then when I listened to his commentary, he said it is a direct 6 Feet Under
and
reference.
And she's in 6 Feet Under. Yeah. I've never seen 6 Feet Under. Yeah. I know it's.
And apparently it is one of his favorite shows of all time as well. So now I know that anytime I see a reference and I'm like, this seems like 6 Feet Under, it probably actually is. And he said that when he first watched the series, he felt like that was the title of the series finale. And he said that felt like the perfect last thing for someone to say. And this was the perfect opportunity for someone to say it. So I just, you know, I was like, yay. And you should watch 6 Feet Under because it's very good.
I've been told.
Yes. So now we cut to Lena in an institution. She's talking to a doctor, shrink, investigator, not really sure who the dude is. But he's trying to get her to remember where her sister might be, which is an important plot point from Ouija. And she suggests that her mother might know. And he's trying to jog her memory, but like she clearly has blocked it all out. She's like, well, ask my mother. If she's dead, Lena. Oh. Like,
The thing is,
and she says, well, basically, here's what it is. My mother wanted to know that we weren't alone after my father died, and now she knows. We were never alone. I'll never be alone.
I'll never be alone again.
And so she's back in her hospital room, and she pulls back the carpet, and she makes the Ouija board in blood to talk to Doris.
And makes a planchette out of some eyeglasses and her fingers.
Yep. And this was the ending that Mike Flanagan liked the best, that in his original ending, Lena is trying to contact Doris and can't. And she just keeps saying, are you there? Are you there? And she gets more and more desperate until you cut to black. But that tested horribly with everyone because everyone was already upset that Doris died. So instead they added, and also Blumhouse was like, it's a horror movie. Like, we know you were all about family drama, but like, this is a horror movie. You have to end with a scare. And he's like, you don't wanna, I'm not gonna, but he did. So the doctor's walking through the halls and we see the two people in her room. You know, it's Lena and Doris is obviously there. That's an actor in a Doris mask. Because they filmed this whole shot practically, like they did it in one take. So it is someone in a Doris mask talking to Annalise Basso in the room. The doctor comes by, and in the meantime, Lulu Wilson is like literally waiting on the ceiling the entire time that they're shooting that.
Crazy.
Yeah. So he comes back and he sees that, you know, Lena is staring him down through the window, and we get that one last demonic Doris jump scare, cut to black. So there is a post-credit scene.
Yeah, I didn't realize the first time.
I did not realize until listening to the commentary because he talked through the credits. So
And so you were like,
yes.
Well, I also got confused because I saw that old woman was listed in both the credits and I was like, but she's not in the movie. Oh, yeah,
Lynn Shay. Lynn Shay is in the original Ouija. She plays older Lena and in present day. And he originally thought that might be an interesting ending, would be to have her, like, to wrap back around and instead of seeing Lena in the institution in the 60s, have her kind of talking in present day and it be Lynn Shay. But then he felt also like it was jarring to have the movie end in a different time period. Like, he didn't, he couldn't see that
when working. You didn't frame it in the beginning with it.
Yeah, he didn't see that working very well. So he abandoned that idea, but they were able to get Lynn Shay back. So he was like, this works for like a post-credit thing. So she's sitting there, she's staring out the window, and someone comes in and they're like, excuse me, your niece is here to talk to you. And that's basically where the movie picks up in Ouija, where the protagonist is going to the institution to talk to her and first meeting her because she says she's her niece. So yeah, there were like a couple of different things he played around with the endings for this. Like, there's a whole extended scene where she sees the ambulances are there and the police officers are there and they're questioning her about what happened in outside the house.
Well, there are sirens in that post-credit scene, I noticed. Mm-hmm. You hear the sirens in the background.
Mm-hmm. So the other thing that he said that was interesting was that people seem to think, because it's Lynn Shay and not much is said, and she isn't even addressed – I don't even think she's addressed by name, that they felt like it was like, oh, so this is part of the Insidious universe. He's like, no, it is not. He's like, great, good job, Mike. So you know, audiences don't always quite get those little subtle things.
Yeah. She is great in that franchise, though.
Yeah. So one of the deleted scenes also, you might be interested to know, was an additional scene with
Lin Shaye?
No, not with Lin Shaye, with Katie Siegel.
Oh.
So this the cut scene that also includes Jenny and her father. It's they're sitting down to dinner and he's talking to her and he's like, I'm so glad you went back for another seance. Like, I'm glad that you, you know, like you now believe me. And, you know, she's like, oh, okay. And so she's like getting up from the table to get something and she's continuing the conversation. And she's like, yeah. And I heard the other voices too. And he's like, I'm sorry, what? And like, she, you know, she's like kind of like looking very, and she turns around and now she's behind him and she's like, I heard the most wonderful, awful things. And she strangles her father because she has become possessed from being at that house too. So like I think that that probably would have opened it up for more of like a sequel of like everyone can get possessed and now it's just spreading like It Follows or whatever.
Yeah, but then you would have, like, it would have been weird to just have her, but then not have, like, the other people that are going in there and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, actually, yeah, there's another piece to that deleted scene that is on a different page of my notes. Here's why it makes sense. Because Doris is in the scene at the house. She's apologizing. And Doris says that... her mom wants to tell her a secret. Come closer, come closer. And then the demonic. Yeah. She does the demonic whisper. And then she asks, was the secret helpful? And Jenny says, yes.
Yeah, I can see why they would have edited that out, though, to make it a little bit more streamlined.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, there are apparently they edited out like almost like 40 minutes of movie. Like we could be here for much longer going through all of the deleted scenes as well. So like, you know, there was a lot that went into this.
But what a good sequel.
I mean, it was so good. Like, honestly, it was much better than the original. And basically, 100%. It had no business being that much better.
Yeah.
But it was made with so much love. Like, the whole idea that Flanagan really wanted to make a movie that you could watch with your family that was, like, one of those, like, scary PG-13 movies that you would grow up watching. He wanted to kind of transfer that nostalgia and parlay it into a movie that you could share that nostalgia with like your kids now and connect over like, well, you liked that the Ouija movie, like let's watch this one. And it would be more like the one that, you know, you grew up watching.
There's also the fact of like the practical effects are really cool. The cigarette burns in the in the frames are really cool about every 20 minutes, which I didn't even know was a thing.
Yeah. So to explain to like if you were wondering, dear listeners, why that happened, basically that's a real change. So anytime that you would be in a movie theater watching a movie, they used to not have digital. It would be film and the canister would have to be switched every so often in order to keep the movie going. And so it was very subtly and carefully done. Like there were things where like frame rates would slightly slow for a second or sound would warp. So they timed out when the real changes would have occurred in the movie theater if you were watching it and it was an old film and they put those in digitally. So, I mean, a lot of love and care went into this, like with the production design. Like, they shot in a house. Like, it wasn't a soundstage. Like, it was, you know, decor, like set deck, like 360 all the way around, you know, like they were really living in that space. And it all pays off. It all shows, you know.
And it also apparently made for like a really good filming experience, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it overall, you know, because it's made with love and because it's made with care, it's something worth watching. Like, I would never go off and just decide one day I want to rewatch Ouija. Like, I'm just done with that one.
Yeah, but no, it's been done.
I would definitely just, like, pick this one up, like, one October, like, if I just felt like watching, like, a, you know, decent horror movie.
Yeah, like 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Real easy. It's not a heavy lift.
I like the vibe.
Has some heft to it.
Love a period piece. Absolutely. You know, especially one from the 60s. I don't know. You know, like, I like it.
Yeah.
And I think physical media is important too. So like if you can get your hands on a Blu-ray, maybe your local library has one, who knows? Or maybe your local library sold it to me.
These are options.
If that's the case, sorry about it.
Well, I think we have covered another fine work of Mr. Flanagan's.
We have. And I think now that we've reached this point in our coverage, we probably should just let everybody know what we're doing next. All right. So I think at this point, instead of keeping you all in suspense, basically our game plan is to like cover like a couple of movies and then do one of his series. And we're pretty much at the point where we're going to tackle one of the series. So why not start with the first one? So we're going to be coming at you with Hill House.
Oh, and my favorite.
Who's excited?
I'm excited. I always love rewatching that show.
I'm so excited. So we're going to be coming at you with that, and we're going to cover it episode by episode. So we hope that you'll join us back in 2 weeks as we do that. And in the meantime, we would love for you to follow us on our socials. Our podcast's social is at FlanacastPod. Michelle, do you want to plug your personal social?
Sure. At Vintage Old Biddy on Facebook, on Instagram, not on TikTok because I'm middle-aged. Same. But yeah, we have a lovely variety show, somewhat monthly, coming at you. So take a look at it.
Yay. And then I do not have another podcast because this is enough for me. But you can follow me on Instagram at bear.reviews.horror, where basically I just post pictures of stuff I'm watching. So,
and we love it. Yeah, and that's great.
That's pretty much my content. Please rate and review our episodes. Help the algorithm help us to find fellow Flana fans out there. We hadn't said Flana fan today yet.
Well, no, we couldn't let it go.
No, we can't. And we're looking for all of you. We want to find you. We want to yell in your ears. We want to whisper in your ears, just like demonic Doris.
And open arm jaws way too wide.
We have such wonderful, horrible things to say to you. So anyway, follow us, subscribe. We want to reach out to
tell
you.
Your friends. Tell your anyone. Friends,
tell everyone.
Except unless they're priests that have a dead wife, then maybe don't have them listen to this.
So anyway, that's us. We've been the Flanacast. I'm Dina Grilli.
I'm Michelle Macaron. May you all have lobster instead of SpaghettiOs.
And always say goodbye.
The Flanacast will return in 2 weeks wherever you get your podcasts. If you liked today's episode, we would love for you to rate and subscribe. It helps get our show into the earbuds of our fellow Flana fans. Join us on Instagram by following us at FlanacastPod for more content. See you soon.